Section 2 of The House Without a Key by Alda Biggers. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Section 2. The High Hat.
John Quincy Winterslip walked aboard the ferry at Oakland feeling rather limp and weary. For more than 6 days he had been marooned on sleepers. His pause at Chicago had been but a flitting from one train to another, and he was fed up. Seeing America first, that was what he had been doing, and what an appalling lot of it there was. He felt that for an eternity he had been staring at endless plains, dotted here and there by unaesthetic houses, the inmates of which had unquestionably never heard a symphony concert. Ahead of him ambled a porter, bearing his two suitcases, his golf clubs, and his hat-box. One of the man's hands was gone, chewed off, no doubt, in some amiable frontier scuffle. In its place he wore a steel hook. Well, no one could question the value of a steel hook to a man in the porter's profession. But how quaint and western! The boy indicated a spot by the rail on the forward deck, and the porter began to unload. Carefully selecting the man's good hand, John Quincy dropped into it a tip so generous as to result in a touching of hook to cap in a weird salute. The object of this attention sank down amid his elaborate trappings, removed the straw hat from his perspiring head, and tried to figure out just what had happened to him. 3,000 miles from Beacon Street, and 2,000 miles still to go! Why, he inquired sourly of his usually pleasant self, had he ever agreed to make this absurd expedition into heathen country? Here it was, late June. Boston was at its best. Tennis at Longwood, long mild evenings in a single shell on the Charles, weekends and golf with Agatha Parker at Magnolia. And if one must travel, there was Paris. He hadn't seen Paris in 2 years, and had been rather planning a quick run-over, when his mother had put this preposterous notion into his head. Preposterous! It was all of that, travelling 5,000 miles just as a gentle hint to Aunt Minerva to return to her calm, well-ordered life behind purple window-panes on Beacon Street. And was there any chance that his strong-minded relative would take the hint? Not one in a thousand. Aunt Minerva was accustomed to do as she pleased. He had an uncomfortable, shocked recollection of one occasion when she had said she would do as she damn well pleased. John Quincy wished he was back. He wished he was crossing Boston Common to his office on State Street, there to put out a new issue of bonds. He was not yet a member of the firm. That was an honour accorded only to the Winterslips, who were bald and a little stooped. But his heart was in his work. He put out a bond issue with loving apprehension, waiting for the verdict as a playwright waits behind the scenes on a first night. Would those first mortgage sixes go over big, or would they flop at his feet? The hoarse boom of a ferry whistle recalled John Quincy to his present unbelievable location on the map. The boat began to move. He was dimly conscious of a young person of feminine gender who came and sat by his side. Away from the slip and out into the harbour, the ferry carried John Quincy, and he suddenly sat up and took notice, for he was never blind to beauty, no matter where he encountered it. And he was encountering beauty now. The morning air was keen and dry and bright. Spread out before him was that harbour, which is like a tired navigator's dream come true. They passed Goat Island, and he heard the faint echo of a bugle. He saw Tamalpais lifting its proud head towards the sparkling sky. He turned, and there was San Francisco scattered blithely over its many hills. The ferry ploughed on, and John Quincy sat very still. A forest of masts and steam funnels. Here was the waterfront that had supplied the atmosphere for those romantic tales that held him spellbound when he was a boy at school. A quiet young Winterslip whom the gypsy strain had missed. Now he could distinguish a bark from Antwerp, a great liner from the Orient, a five-masted schooner that was reminiscent of those supposedly forgotten stories. Ships from the treaty ports, ships from coconut islands in southern seas, a picture as intriguing and colourful as a black drop in a theatre, but far more real. Suddenly John Quincy stood up. A puzzled look had come into his calm grey eyes. I don't understand, he murmured. He was startled by the sound of his own voice. He hadn't intended to speak aloud. In order not to appear too utterly silly, he looked around for someone to whom he might pretend to have addressed that remark. There was no one about, except the young person who was obviously feminine, and therefore not to be informally accosted. John Quincy looked down at her, Spanish or something like that, blue-black hair, dark eyes that were alight now with the amusement she was striving to hide, a delicate oval face, tanned a deep brown. He looked again at the harbour. Beauty all about the boat, and beauty on it, much better than travelling on trains. The girl looked up at John Quincy. She saw a big, broad-shouldered young man, with a face as innocent as a child's. A bit of friendliness, she decided instantly, would not be misunderstood. "I beg your pardon," she said. "Oh, I'm sorry," he stammered. "I didn't mean—I spoke without intending. I said I didn't understand—" "You didn't understand what?" "A most amazing thing has happened," he continued. He sat down and waved his hand toward the harbour. "I've been here before." She looked perplexed. "Lots of people have," she admitted. "But, you see, I mean, I've never been here before." She moved away from him. "Lots of people haven't," she admitted that, too. John Quincy took a deep breath. What was this discussion he had got into, anyhow? He had a quick impulse to lift his hat gallantly and walk away, letting the matter drop. But no, he came of a race that sees things through. "I'm from Boston," he said. "Oh," said the girl. That explained everything. "And what I'm trying to make clear, although of course there's no reason why I should have dragged you into it." "None whatever," she smiled. "But go on." "Until a few days ago I was never west of New York, never in my whole life, you understand. Been about New England a bit and abroad a few times, but the West—" "I know, it didn't interest you." "I wouldn't say that," protested John Quincy with careful politeness. "But there was such a lot of it, exploring it seemed a hopeless undertaking. And then, the family thought I ought to go, you see, so I rode and rode on trains and was—you'll pardon me—a bit bored. Now I come into this harbour, I look around me, and I get the oddest feeling. I feel that I've been here before." The girl's face was sympathetic. "Other people have had that experience," she told him. "Choice souls they are. You've been a long time coming, but you're home at last." She held out a slim brown hand. "Welcome to your city," she said. John Quincy solemnly shook hands. "Oh, no," he corrected gently. "Boston's my city. I belong there, naturally, but this is familiar." He glanced northward at the low hills, sheltering the Valley of the Moon, then back at San Francisco. "Yes, I seem to have known my way about here once. Astonishing, isn't it? Perhaps some of your ancestors—" "That's true. My grandfather came out here when he was a young man. He went home again, but his brothers stayed. It's the son of one of them I'm going to visit in Honolulu."
"Oh, you're going to Honolulu?"
"Tomorrow morning. Have you been there?"
"Yes."
Her dark eyes were serious. "See, there are the locks. That's where the east begins, the real east, and Telegraph Hill." She pointed. No one in Boston ever points, but she was so lovely John Quincy overlooked it. "And Russian Hill, and the Fairmont on Nob Hill." "Life must be full of ups and downs," he ventured lightly. "Tell me about Honolulu. Sort of a wild place, I imagine." She laughed. "I'll let you discover for yourself how wild it is," she told him. "Practically all the leading families came originally from your beloved New England. Puritans with a touch of sun, my father calls them. He's clever, my father," she added in an odd childish tone that was wistful and at the same time challenging. "I'm sure of it," said John Quincy heartily. They were approaching the ferry building, and other passengers crowded about them. "I'd help you with that suitcase of yours, but I've got all this truck. If we could find a porter—"
"Don't bother," she answered. "I can manage very well."
She was staring down at John Quincy's hat-box. I suppose there's a silk hat in there?" she inquired.
"Naturally," replied John Quincy.
She laughed, a rich, deep-throated laugh. John Quincy stiffened slightly. "Oh, forgive me," she cried. "But a silk hat in Hawaii?" John Quincy stood erect. The girl had laughed at a winter slip. He filled his lungs with the air sweeping in from the open spaces, the broad open spaces where men are men.
A weird, reckless feeling came over him. He stooped, picked up the hat-box, and tossed it calmly over the rail. It bobbed indignantly away. The crowd closed in, not wishing to miss any further exhibition of madness. "That's that," said John Quincy quietly. "Oh!" gasped the girl. "You shouldn't have done it!" And indeed he shouldn't. The box was an expensive one, the gift of his admiring mother at Christmas, and the topper inside, worn in the gloaming along the waterside of Beacon Street, had been known to add a touch of distinction even to that distinguished scene. "Why not?" asked John Quincy. "The confounded thing's been a nuisance ever since I left home. And besides, we do look ridiculous at times, don't we Easterners? A silk hat in the tropics. I might have been mistaken for a missionary." He began to gather up his luggage. "Shan't need a porter any more," he announced gaily. "I say, it was awfully kind of you, letting me talk to you like that." "It was fun," she told him. "I hope you're going to like us out here. We're so eager to be liked, you know. It's almost pathetic." "Well," smiled John Quincy, "I've met only one Californian to date, but—" "Yes?" "So far, so good." "Oh, thank you." She moved away. "Please, just a moment," called John Quincy. I wish— But the crowd surged between them. He saw her dark eyes smiling at him, and then, irrevocably as the hat, she drifted from his sight.
End of chapter 2.